Shavua Tov, a good week. Please have a seat. It is so wonderful to see so many faces and people who've come out on a Saturday night to learn, to get to hear from our scholar in residence, Arnold Roth, who's come to be with us from Yerushalayim to share, as those of us who were together in the afternoon, a little bit more poignant story earlier about the experiences of terror and the loss of his own daughter. Tonight will be a little bit more focused on some of the realities of terror from his political perspective on what continues to be a global phenomenon, a spreading phenomenon. And I particularly want to thank, I'm looking for Brian Shore and the whole entire Shore family for making this possible, for creating for our community a ongoing, what will now be an ongoing scholar in residence series. And Arnold, you're number one. So I know we say Acharon Acharon Chaviv, the last is most dear, but all beginnings are hard, and it's really wonderful to have you on what is a hard topic, a difficult topic, but also one that really is something that affects so many people in so many ways. We are living in an age, certainly, where fear sometimes seems to dominate the news cycle or even how we react to the world. And one of the many fruits that terror intends to sow and to reap ultimately is the fruit of fear and how it takes away from the basic conditions of society which allow us to work together. So with that said, with introduction, enough words from me, I just want to turn the floor over to you, Arnold, and we're so very grateful that you're here to share your insights with us.
Good evening, Shavua Tov. I want to make sure that I don't forget, as I've forgotten in two of my previous speaking opportunities, to thank the Neve Shalom community in general, to thank Rabbi Kozak in particular, to thank the Shore family for everything that they've done to facilitate what I think is a valuable contribution to the life of the community, and a valuable opportunity for me to, as I said this afternoon, release some steam from this volcano that is growing inside me over a period of some years. The topic is not a simple topic, and it will be important for me to try to impress upon you the parts that ought not to be affected at all by whatever political views you bring into the room. The subject of terrorism is too important for us to allow politics to get in its way. I did it right the first time, there's a good chance I'll do it right the next time. The concept of terrorism has multiple dimensions, and I want to make clear from the outset that it's not my intention to shoehorn or even try to blend together all of them in tonight's presentation, because that would be futile, boring, and inappropriate to what brings us here together tonight. My focus is on, and lest the point not be entirely clear to you, I do see myself as a victim. I see myself as someone whose life has been turned upside down when I didn't want it to be upside down, by reason of the kind of horrible thing that we do think about as parents in our worst nightmares. And unfortunately, my worst nightmare really did come true. It did affect me. It does affect me. It's changed a great deal of my life. It's changed what I do for a living. It's changed the way I look at my surviving family members, my wife, my children, and it certainly makes an enormous difference to the way I look at the rest of the world. The challenges that face societies in a terrorism-rich era, that's as much your problem as it is mine, as I am going to try to emphasize again and again. Terrorism is not a problem of Israelis. And societies and governments, what they can do, what they can't do, and what they ought to do. It's impossible for us to do justice to all of those focuses, but those are the focuses that I have in mind as I get started. I also want to make sure that you understand I'm not proposing to address at all politics or religion. I'm not proposing to offer suggestions about law enforcement or military strategies. I'm not proposing to do a review of who the terrorists are and who are not, whether they operate as lone wolves or as an insurgency or as an invading force to get what they want. And I have no intention of addressing the subject of asylum seekers. What I do intend is to speak about insights that I've gotten from being directly touched by this awful phenomenon. Terrorism, to be clear about it, is not being defeated. The terrorists are not being defeated, and we are going to pay an ever higher price unless we can unite across political, ethnic, and religious lines to defeat those who do it and those who advance their goals, which is essentially the same thing. So, to restate my themes for the presentation that Rabbi Kozak has asked me to confine to no more than 4.5 hours tonight, what is terror and why is the matter of defining it so complex and so fraught? The victims of the terrorists, what's being done right for them and what's not, and do the victims even have a role? And what's ahead? What should we be doing and what can we do? There's no easy way to say this, and I know that if my wife were in the room, I'd probably ask her to leave the room now. And I've spoken quietly to Yael, and she is either looking away or just having a very hard time with my putting this picture up on the screen. We're here to honour the life and the death of Yoni. That's the reason for the event and for the program that's being introduced here in the shul. There are awful jokes, about preachers who are called in to deliver a eulogy about someone they don't know. And they tend to make up things about the selflessness or other values of that person. I make no pretense about having known Yoni. I didn't know Yoni. But anybody who lives in Israel and is subjected to the, not subjected, is witness to the potted life reviews, like this one. This is Yoni in the local newspaper in the community where his family lives. It reinforces the sense that we're all one family. Now, we're not all one family, but it is meaningful to say that we function as a family, particularly at times that are really hideous. Really hideous is when the person down the street has lost a child. At least in Israel, there is an approach to this which I think is very it's praiseworthy. It's not as good as it ought to be because there is a compulsion to move on from the event of terror, move on from the loss and get on with life, because otherwise, as the awful cliche has it, we'll be giving the terrorists a victory. The fact is that the terrorists already have a victory. There's their victory. They wanted somebody to be dead, and he's dead. Of course, it's a very odd kind of victory. It's a victory that expresses itself in bigotry and hatred. I'm not going to dwell on this, but I do want to say that this is good and this is awful. This is good that we're not allowing the day to go by without remembering that there was a life behind the photograph of the man who is no longer here to embrace his mother and his father and his wife and his children. It's bad in the sense that the next week he's not there. The paper is gone and we've moved on to other issues. It's sweeping away the broken glass. I was struck with it. I was struck by the way this was done in my own case. There was a restaurant, it was blown up. Everyone was terribly upset. And a week later, the restaurant was back in business. And if we have enough time, I'll tell you what the people who owned the restaurant said to all of the families of the victims, but I won't do that now. Does honoring and remembering Yoni Shur mean that we want to take revenge and create more victims in his name? Obviously, you know the answer. The answer is no. You would be astonished at how much confusion there is in the minds of various publics, including Jews in Israel, Jews in the United States, Jews in Australia, who think that the notion that we owe ourselves and the victims the obligation of looking at the photograph and remembering the lives that no longer are here, that were stolen from them and from their families and from all of us, who think that that amounts to some kind of vengeance. It isn't anything of the sort. And my experience, having spoken to, I'd have to say, thousands at this stage of people who have themselves been victims of terror, is that no one more vigorously and more sincerely wants peace and a resolution to whatever conflict brought the hideosity of the terrorists into their lives than people who've paid for it through the flesh of their family members and themselves. What we do when we remember the victims is reassert that the terrorists and their victims are, and please hear these words carefully, not two sides of the same coin. You'll understand why I've emphasized that in a few minutes. Morally, there is no comparison between the innocent victims and those who pursue terrorist goals. That may seem obvious to everyone in the room tonight because of the framework in which we're having this discussion. It's not obvious. It's not obvious to most of the journalists who I've met over the last 15 years. It's not obvious to a lot of the politicians that I've met over the last 15 years. We hold values very different from the practitioners of terror, and we owe it to ourselves to ensure that people know that. This is my daughter, and this is me. This was the birthday that I had several months before she was murdered. We had an evening in the family where all we did was have a lovely meal and then use a borrowed video camera, because phones didn't have video cameras in those days. We actually had to go out and rent a video camera. And we recorded for posterity the enjoyment of a family at peace with itself, a family of people, parents and children, who not only love each other, but also like each other and like spending time together. One of the filmmakers who came to record an interview with my wife asked to see this video and took it away, and we've never seen it again. We don't have any copies. For those of you who don't know, Malky was one of the people inside the Sbarro Pizzeria on the 9th of August 2001. When a young man from Hamas, carrying a guitar case, walked into the pizzeria at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, having decided that he would ignore the instructions of his handler, which were to go to the corner, to the street, to the corner of King George and Jaffa Road. I'm sure many of you who know Jerusalem know exactly the corner that I mean. And to explode in the middle of the intersection when the lights are red in all four directions. Not anymore, because today we have the light rail and there are no cars on that street, but there used to be cars and buses, and there used to be a four-way pedestrian crossing. And the handler, who had checked out the scene by being in Jerusalem several days earlier, said, "You need to be standing in the middle of the intersection when all of the children cross," because this was 2 o'clock on a school holiday afternoon in August. He evidently noticed that there were more people inside the pizzeria, which had a glass curtain wall and you could see right inside, than there were in the intersection. And that's why he was standing next to my daughter and her best friend when he pressed the button and went to his 72 virgins. I know a lot about the man, and I know a lot about the instructions, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. Just let me sit where I am. That's where I want to be. It will be very helpful if I could find somebody in the audience who has read the United Nations Convention Against Terrorism and can help us explain what its contents are. Any lawyers, international lawyers, somebody can talk about the International Convention Against Terrorism of the United Nations. The definition of terrorism is in that convention. Nobody. There isn't one. And there never will be one. The United Nations has been grappling to define terrorism for close on 50 years. What they've got is an ad hoc committee on terrorism in what's called the Sixth Committee, the Legal Committee of the United Nations General Assembly. And it's been trying to reach a legal definition so that all kinds of consequential pieces of actionable law can follow, a treaty, a convention, individual rights, individual laws that can be then embodied in the legislation of individual countries, and they've been blocked. They've been blocked by the OIC. Can somebody tell me what the OIC is? Come on, this is Portland, you're educated people. The OIC. OIC is the largest body of countries inside the United Nations. It's an unstoppable block. You cannot pass any resolutions in the United Nations unless the OIC is not opposed. OIC? Organization of Islamic Cooperation. It has 54, I think, nation states, or 56, and they are opposed to any definition of terrorism which fails to give a free pass to the Palestinians. In other words, so long as the Palestinians want to say that their acts of terrorism are not terrorism at all, there will be no convention at the United Nations. But there's another dimension to all of this when it comes to definition. What do we call terrorism? CVE. CVE is an American invention, and it stands for... Come on, I know you're all tuned into American politics here. CVE is a creation of the current pre-Trump administration. It is a euphemism. It is countering violent extremism. The word terrorism is now expunged from the policy lexicon of the US government for almost all purposes, has been now for a couple of years. And it's not the only euphemism. I've mentioned up there as well, is OCO there? Yes, there it is. OCO is the euphemism for terrorism, for a certain kind of terrorism, that is now in the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, and therefore it appears in the budget papers, which anybody can check to see, that cover the military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we're no longer, in American terms, and I'm not an American, able to talk at the level of government about terrorism. It's been rebranded for reasons that I'm not going to go into, but you should be going into. In my opinion, it's a subject that at least is worth thinking about. Why is it necessary to take the name terrorism off the table? And I'll give you an indication of just how much of a loaded issue it is, and I'm speaking here from personal experience. In 2014, the State Department requested the government of Israel to release what turned out to be 104 convicted terrorists from, this is a euphemism, the pre-Oslo era, meaning that if the Oslo Agreement took place in 1994, 1995, the intention was people who were convicted of offences before then. In fact, that was never the actual intention. And in fact, of the 104, we know the names of all of them, there were quite a number who had been convicted and imprisoned after 1994, but that's a small issue. The Kerry State Department requested and got a commitment from the government of Israel to release in four separate tranches the terrorists who had been convicted and sentenced to generally multiple life terms and were not due to be released, wanted them to be released as a way of bringing the Palestinian Authority to the negotiating table. Now, leaving the political dimensions of this aside, and I can assure you I am because of the way this played out, people who were themselves victims of those terrorists who had been sentenced to multiple terms of life imprisonment and were now about to get out were upset. They were upset for several reasons. The first and obvious reason is no one asked them. The second reason is, but what does this mean about Israeli justice? These people have been sentenced in a court. No one questioned the competence or the jurisdiction of the court. They were sentenced according to law, and they have not fulfilled their sentences. They have not been paroled, and in almost every case, they haven't exhibited any sign of having changed their views that put them in there in the first place, which led to the acts of terrorism. Well, what we did was quite effective. A small ad hoc group of which I was one of the members formed itself and immediately went around among other people. We got quite a number of signatures, all of them signatures of people like my wife and me, parents of children who have been murdered by people who are now on the inside. As it happens, none of the people in the pre-Oslo group had anything to do with my life, but I was really just there to give moral support and to give some organizational help. And we wrote a letter, and we had that letter personally delivered to Mr. Carey, and it was in fact received. And then after some clever footwork that involved a correspondent who covers the State Department for Associated Press, some of you may know who I'm talking about, it's been the same person for some years, we arranged for a question to be asked at the daily briefing of the State Department, and leaving a lot of the detail out, the question from the Associated Press correspondent, who has no particular love for Israel, was to Murray, blanking on her name, the assistant spokesperson of the State Department at the time, Murray Harf, H-A-R-F. The question was, have you received a letter today from a group of terror victims in Israel, and is there going to be a response, and do you consider the people who are going to be released under the pressure of the State Department to be terrorists? So the answer, which I've got on video, is yes, we received the letter, we're preparing our response now, and as to whether they are terrorists, we'll get back to you. And the journalist, who's no fool, said, are you being serious? These people, in most cases, have been serving prison terms of 25 years or more. If you haven't decided whether they're terrorists, when will you decide whether they're terrorists, and why are you even raising the question? I'll get back to you. And he raised another question. He was quite persistent. And eventually she said, listen, Matt, I'll get back to you. Well, we're waiting for her 3 years later, almost 3 years, to get back to us on the letter. And you, Americans, need to know, in my opinion, I'm trying to sound as respectful as I can possibly be. I am respectful. That your State Department has no idea as to whether these people are terrorists or not. Now, this is not a semantic issue, and it's certainly not a legal classification issue, unless you're prepared to undermine and impugn the Israeli justice system. But the Israeli justice system sentenced these people not for their political viewpoints, not for handing out leaflets, not for writing messages on Facebook that were considered to be incitement, but for acts of murder. Every person in that list of 104 was a murderer. As it turned out, three of the four tranches, they were going to be released in four tranches, three of the four tranches were complete, and I don't know the number now, how does that work out, 76 or so of those people are now free, and only the last quarter, for various political reasons, were not freed and are still in prison, serving the terms to which they were sentenced 20, 30 years ago. I'm not outraged by the fact that the prisoners were released because I, as we'll come to, we've gotten used to the idea that prisoners who have been sentenced in a perfectly legitimate system of justice to long terms are released on a nonsense basis or to achieve some political goal. I'm okay with that. At this stage, I'm okay with that. What I'm not okay with is the notion that the United States State Department cannot answer the question of whether these murderers are terrorists or not and has no problem saying it to the correspondent of the Associated Press with cameras rolling and has no problem ignoring the repeated follow-up letters that my colleagues and I sent to them by name. Okay. The first thing to say about what it means to be a victim is to repeat something I said here this afternoon when Rabbi Cusack and I had a very I would say, emotionally charged discussion about what our personal experiences were. In case there's anyone here who doesn't know, Rabbi Kosack was himself almost blown to bits in a terrorist attack, but was lucky enough to escape injury. And my story you've already heard. And I said at the time, this afternoon, that if you walk into a bookstore, and there were some people in the room who knew what a bookstore was, most people don't anymore because there are no bookstores in most cities, but if, for argument's sake, you go online to Amazon or a book depository and you look for books on grief and bereavement, you'll find a solid library. There are lots of those books because it's a well-recognized human need. When you go through grief and bereavement, particularly if you've never experienced it before, you are generally going to look for some help because it's one of the most difficult passages in life. If the grief and bereavement in your life happens to have stemmed from a crime, then you should know that that's a different kind of literature. And it's also relatively rich. It's a much smaller literature. It takes several bookshelves if there were a physical bookstore which was holding the books, but the books are there. If you're looking for consolation and guidance and advice by reason of being a victim of terrorism, you're going to have a very hard time. I personally know only one or two titles that have already been published, and they're good or not good depending on your perspective, but whatever it is, you don't have a great choice. It's an area which is laden with emotion and with difficulty of coming to terms with the issues, but it's attracting very little writer attention at this stage. Now, whatever the reason for that is, it doesn't matter, because my point is, if you need help, I'm here to tell you that it's difficult to find. The issue of being a victim of terrorism raises monumentally complex considerations. It begs intervention by people who are really competent. As I also said this afternoon, I think that there are some wonderful people in Israel who do this for a living, and most of them work for the government, and I'm proud to say that. I think it's a wonderful thing. But whichever way you look at it, whether you're interested in books or whether you're interested in psychologists or whether you're in Israel or in Australia, it isn't being well addressed. People don't understand the issues. And I'm going to interrupt myself to talk a little bit about one of my children and what she went through. I'm generally very careful to not identify any of my children in the course of talking about how my family came through this and is coming through this nightmare process. But in this case, I have to tell you that it's one of my daughters. I have three daughters who are alive today, and therefore I'm not going to be any more particular than that. But this is a daughter who was devastated by the loss of her sister, but really devastated. As we now know, she was actually a post-traumatic syndrome person. She needed the care that comes with being in that condition, and she didn't get it. She certainly didn't get it at school. Instead, what she did get, this is a school in the city where we live. I hope everybody knows that the city where I live is called Jerusalem. And as you know, Jerusalem has, unfortunately, a tremendous familiarity with terrorism, which means that there are many families, by my calculation, at least 1,500 families in Jerusalem who have been directly touched by terrorism, a brother, a child, a husband, a cousin. That's a lot of people. That probably means that every school in the city has at least one. Notwithstanding, my daughter went through, I would have to say, a process of, she wasn't well treated. And my daughter is a very sweet young girl. She's now becoming a speech therapist, but 15 years have gone by. She's very competent, very capable, and very attractive in a personality sense, in all senses, but especially her personality person. It's not as if she was repulsive. And yet, within the school, nobody wanted to deal with her issues at all. Not the principal, not the school psychologist, not the class teacher, none of the staff, taking the lead, I have to say, from one of the leading personalities in the school, who happens to be one of our immediate neighbours, lives in the same building. So a person who really knew our family well and didn't have the educational training himself to know how to deal with having a child who had just gone through one of life's truly great traumas. But instead of owning up to this, every time a discipline issue arose, and my child suddenly became, for the first time in her life, a discipline issue. She came late to class. She played up in class. She was unhappy. She couldn't focus. Instead of dealing with what was clearly a case that needed some mature, incisive intervention. She was repeatedly, day after day, sent to stand outside the principal's office, and the principal was incredibly dismissive. Came Yom HaZikaron, Memorial Day, the day before Israel's Independence Day, and the principal made the decision that our daughter, my daughter's older sister, I'm speaking now about Malki, who had graduated from that school, would not be mentioned, and indeed was not mentioned for the next 3 years, which was the length of time that my daughter remained in that school before we finally woke up and pulled her out of there and put her into another school. Failed to acknowledge the only child in the history of the school who had ever been murdered in an act of terror. This had implications on us, but of course we're not the same victims as our younger daughter. Our younger daughter's in the school, her friends are part of the school, the teachers who all know the story are all pretending they don't notice that Malki is not being remembered in the ceremony, and this other child, my younger daughter, keeps getting sent to the principal's office. At a certain point, we did what in Australian psychology is called spit the dummy. That means we ran out of patience. And my wife wrote an exceptionally sensitive and articulate letter to the director of education in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Education Authority is called Manchi, Minhelet Chinuch. And the letter was not a complaint about any of the individuals concerned. It was a cry for help. It was saying, do you realize how many families are just like ours who have a child in the educational system and nobody from the principal on down has any idea how to deal with those children? I'm the mother of a child in this particular school, and therefore I don't speak about any of the other schools and I don't know what's going on in the other schools. But here's what's going on in the school where my child is, and it's deeply disturbing to me. Are you aware of this? Two things happened. First of all, without telling us, they sent a copy of that letter to the principal, who then arranged for his wife to write back a very sharply worded letter, which was basically all criticizing us. A very low-level kind of response. The next response was that the chief superintendent of psychological services in the Jerusalem area called my wife personally and said, I was very moved and very disturbed by your letter. Would you consider coming to a seminar which we plan to hold in which we will have school counselors from all over the country and perhaps you could address these issues? And it took some time for my wife to make up her mind to do it, but she did it. And I sat through that and watched, and it was incredibly moving because person after person got up among the participants and said, we know that this war of terrorism is going in a direction that we don't really know where it's going to end. This was 2003. And we clearly have these problems, but no one has prepared us for this. Can I just repeat that statement? In the state of Israel, the school psychologists gathered together in response to an angry mother's letter say, we haven't been prepared for this. Now I want to say to you, you live in Portland, Oregon. I don't know if anybody's been preparing the people in your school. I honestly don't know. It's not that I'm saying I know that they haven't been prepared. I don't know. But people in this community and in every other community that I can ever address need to think about that issue and perhaps decide that on a preemptive basis it would be worth looking into whether the schools are able to deal with the problem of terrorism as it affects children. Now, thankfully, you don't know the scale of the problem that we know in Israel. And the problem in Israel is on a colossal scale. It's a terrible, it's a tragic scale. And in Jerusalem, it's particularly tragic because the numbers are so great. But to have an education system that's not ready to deal with that, that's beyond comprehension. That was the case. Up until that conference, nothing was being done. After that conference, a lot was being done. So something very good came out of this. But it didn't come out of a self-correcting process. The system didn't heal itself. An angry mother slapped the system into shape. The first time I ever met terror victims who were not Israeli came when I got a phone call from the foreign ministry in Jerusalem asking me if I would be willing to join a group of other Israeli terror victims and go to a European country to attend the first ever conference of terror victims from all over the place. I had to think hard for about a second before I said yes, and later found that four of us had been selected, four people together with a government official, and the organization that was putting this on was duly notified, and we made plans to travel to that European country. The day before we were due to leave, I got another call from the same person in the foreign ministry who said, "We've just been notified by the organizers that there's a strong desire for Israel not to be seen to be participating, so please don't come." Naturally, we went. Naturally, we were there the next day, and we walked into a hall that was filled with people, an electric atmosphere, people who represented a tremendous cross-section of interested parties. They included lots of widows, people like ourselves, other Europeans who had clearly been the parents of people who'd been murdered by the terrorists, quite a lot of media people, and then a solid sprinkling of figures from other governments. The most notable of those governments, and I noticed it, and it was striking, I almost couldn't breathe, was a delegation from Iran. A delegation from Iran was there to participate in a terror victims conference. We were, of course, persona non grata, so that as we walked into the hall, it was possible to see on the stage a table had been set, a dais, there was going to be an official speaker, and then there were going to be representatives of, and I don't remember the exact countries, but I'm going to guess that it was Ireland, Colombia, Spain, France, and somebody else. Representatives of each of these countries, victims. And there was going to be, and there was, an official spokesperson who was going to open the event. And just before it got started, somebody tapped me on the shoulder and I turned around and a man introduced himself to me. He called himself an official in the government. I now know that he's the state comptroller of that particular country. And he said to me in a perfect English, "I understand you speak English." I said, "Yes." He said, "I've just heard that my government is trying to squeeze the Israelis out of this. Are you willing to be part of the group up on the stage now?" I wasn't sure what to say, but I looked at him. He seemed serious. So I said, "Sure." He said, "But no politics." So I said, "I don't actually think that politics comes into this, but thank you for the advice." And a minute later, I was up on the stage. I was sitting there over on the side at the same table. Everyone had their country name there, and I didn't. And everybody spoke. My recollection is at least three of the four people spoke in explicitly political terms about the issues concerning terrorism in their country. And I didn't. What I did was spoke about the silence in my home, about our inability to talk about Malki, about the fear that raising the subject again, and this was already 2 years, almost, it was 2.5 years after her murder, would create tensions and passions that I certainly don't know how to quell. And so we'd be walking around this elephant in the room, pretending that it wasn't there. That's what I spoke about. And I said, it's a terrible feeling to be alone in this process of trying to make life make sense after an act of murder. I said, I walk out onto the street of Jerusalem where I live, and there are people even today who will cross the street so that they don't have to see me. Not because I offended them, not because they offended me, but because nobody's ever told them how to deal with a situation like this. They don't know what to say. So they deal with it until today by crossing the street. We've lost a lot of friends, I said. It's true. We've gained new friends, people who have had the same kind of experience. I said that the inability to confront our loss extends even into members of the family, certainly members of our community, and certainly strangers. And the most rewarding interactions that we have had, I said, were those where somebody came up to us, particularly in the week of Shiva, of sitting in our home, when we must have had at least 2,500 people come through, most of whom we'd never seen before. And people would take our hands and say, "I don't know what to say." I said to the audience, that to me is the most honest and the most helpful statement. And I'm grateful for the people who found their way into our homes to say this. And then I sat down. I spoke for 3 minutes. Immediately afterwards, a group of, this is a non-English speaking country that I'm talking about, a group of women all dressed in black sort of formed at the bottom of the stage, and they wanted to speak to me, and they started speaking in their language, which unfortunately, Tatiana, I do not speak. I only speak English and Hebrew and Yiddish. But somebody from the Guardian newspaper, who was standing off on the side, volunteered to be the translator, and he told me, they're all the widows of police officers who've been killed over the last few years, and their message is, you spoke for them, and they want to thank you. That you said things that nobody's ever said on their behalf, and they're very moved. Well, I was very moved, obviously. It was an eye-popping experience. I went down from the stage, and with the help of a translator, I had a lot of other conversations, as did the other three members of our group, with a large number of people there. And I'm going somewhere with the story, but I'm going to interrupt this by saying this was an eye-popping experience, an eye-opening experience, the idea that with all that makes Israel a special place, in the negative sense now, a place that has a terrible problem with people who want to blow up our children, it was extraordinary to find that we had more in common with these people whose language we didn't share than in many ways we have with the people who live on the same street that we live on. Gross generalization, but still, it's an important generalization. We had two remarkable days, I would say magical days, of discussions there. For my own part, I made connections there with people who have become friends and are still my friends 14 years later. At a certain point, somebody said, that's the foreign minister. And indeed, there was a pompous-looking political gentleman. Did I say that? I'm so sorry. Making his way through the very busy lobby of this hall in this European country. And all of us, the four of us plus the handlers from the Israeli embassy, walked over to this fellow and grabbed him. I didn't grab him, but there were people less politically correct than me who did grab him. And somebody yelled at him and said, how dare you treat us as unwanted guests at your event while you invite the Iranians here? And other statements in that spirit. And the diplomat, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, to give him his full title, said, he's not a politician for nothing, you're making a good point, why don't we discuss it in the foreign ministry tomorrow? I invite you to come. And we went. If I'm not mistaken, he's the current ambassador of his country to Washington. But this was in 2004, February. We're all sitting there politely. We're all conducting ourselves as if we're grown-ups. He says, tell me about your concerns, and we tell him one after the other. There's a young woman next to me was probably a table away from you, Rabbi, in the Frank Sinatra Cafe. Her boyfriend was killed that day, and she was very badly injured. And there are two others who you don't see. And he listens politely and he nods politely, and as we keep talking, he seems to have a tremendous appetite for hearing how upset we are. And somebody said something and that changed the temperature. I don't remember what it was. And then he said, being candid, I think for the first time, he said, listen, you're not really terror victims. The terror victims are the people in my country. You're the victims of a political process. You have to go home and tell your government, tell Sharon, and tell your Knesset that you have to solve the Palestinian problem because it's a political problem. It's not terrorism. Well, that wasn't what I was expecting to hear, and I thought it was particularly insensitive. So, conducting myself in a way which does not come natural to me, I puffed myself up, and while still seated, said, Your Excellency, you may be surprised at how the people on the terrorism side view these issues. You think you don't have any problems with them, but it could be that you do. You're worried about your domestic terrorists, but the terrorists who've embittered our lives don't actually respect borders. He became very upset. In fact, I'm not going to stretch it out anymore. I've written about this. I'm scratching the rest of the conversation. We left the room. We were not friendly with each other. It was a very tense and unpleasant ending to it. And several days later, the trains exploded in Madrid, which is, of course, where we were sitting. And the government which had appointed him fell a few days later. The Spanish elections took place just at that time. And far from being persona non grata, I personally received three invitations from the new Spanish government to come and speak to a shocked Spanish intelligentsia over the next 2 years, trying to address the issue of what did we do wrong? How could it be that Spanish-born Muslims went onto the trains at Atocha, the station in central Madrid, and murdered well over 200 people, and we had no idea, we didn't know we had a dispute with them. We thought that this was all about the Basques. Well, that kind of experience, unfortunately, is an expensive way to get an education about how terrorism works. The Australians went through a similar process at about the same time. The bombing of a nightclub in Bali, on Kota Beach, massacre in, I think, 2004, prompted the editor of Australia's one of the highest selling newspapers, not the highest brow newspapers, the Herald Sun, to contact me. You're a terror victim, you're Australian, your daughter is Australian, she was murdered. Can you write something to address the parents of the people who were killed yesterday in Bali? Again, I only had to think for a second, of course. I wrote something, I sent it to him. It was a good piece. It was a thoughtful piece. It wasn't at all political. It was really addressing the problem in humanitarian terms. And after it wasn't published for a week, I wrote to the editor of the Herald Sun and I said, was it something I said? And then a week after that, I wrote him another letter because he hadn't answered me. And I said, is there something that you want to tell me about my article? I've actually never had a response from him, and my article was not published by the Herald Sun, though it was published in a number of other newspapers. This brings us back to Spain. This picture is to illustrate the way in which what seems very cut and dried, what seems very cut and dried to us, an act of terrorism against innocent people, which ought to evoke wall-to-wall sympathy, is translated by one of the Spanish thinking newspapers as... Can anybody translate this for us? One person in a big voice. Hands up. What does it say? Oh, if you can't see, then we'll... Okay. Bush is concerned that Sharon is proposing to annihilate the Palestinian people. That's the message that the Spanish intelligentsia, via one of the most important newspapers in Spain, were given after the massacre in Sabaro. That's the Sparrow restaurant, the pizzeria. You can't see my daughter, but she's there. I didn't see this, fortunately, for 3 or 4 years until after it had appeared. But it says so much to me about the way in which distance operates and the way in which political correctness prevents people from dealing with the reality that is staring them in their faces. How can you, in conscience, as a journalist, as an editor, subvert a story as absolutely clear as a terror attack and turn it into a political pitch about something that never happened? Well, of course, as you get to see the way in which parts of the media report on some of these sensitive issues, you cease to be surprised. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Barghouti. I'm speaking here of Marwan Barghouti. But I can tell you that he personally, with his own two hands, paid for the bomb that murdered my daughter. The bomb was inside a guitar case. He was the one who funded it. And in the immediate aftermath, when the attackers, the members of the gang, fled Jerusalem, he held several of them in his own home until he thought that it was safe for them to go out and therefore was an accessory after the fact of my daughter's murder. I don't have any sympathy for Marwan Barghouti, even though I know that there are Israeli politicians who think that he's on our side, he's a great guy, and he ought to be the next chairman or president of the Palestinian Authority. And I'm not one of them. And I'm looking at him not in political terms now. I'm simply saying, reminding everybody, Marwan Barghouti is in that poster because he's sitting in jail serving multiple life terms for murder. And in case you're not aware of all of the details of it, the chief murder, the murder that was at the top of the list when he was convicted, was only a small part of the list of murders. Most of the rest were dropped by the prosecution. Was of a Jewish man with a long beard who was driving a car, only he wasn't Jewish. He was a Greek Orthodox priest. For some reason, you will find it very difficult to see that reported in any of the media. Because there's some cognitive dissonance there. The man is a hero of the Palestinian people. He wants to be the next president. There are plenty of people who want him to be the next president, including this man. This is a previous Nobel Prize winner. His name is Tutu, and he wants Barghouti to be the next Nobel Peace Prize winner. And it doesn't bother him that Barghouti is a convicted, unrepentant, multiple murderer, convicted in an open court, not in a military court, of an act of murder, of several acts of murder, including the murder of this long-bearded Jew who isn't a Jew at all, he's a Greek Orthodox priest. I don't understand any of this, I've got to say. I am not politically unsophisticated. I don't understand how somebody like, for instance, Tutu, who is a retired archbishop with a colossal reputation, has done remarkably good things in the South African context, and who is now heart and soul trying to rehabilitate the name of a convicted, unrepentant murderer and pretending that Barghouti is an agent for peace. When every statement that Barghouti, that I've seen, and I've been following Barghouti closely since I sat through his murder trial in 2005, I think, I was in the trial in Tel Aviv, every public statement that he's issued has been a statement that reinforces the message that only by force, only by what I would call terrorism, he would not call it terrorism, but he doesn't mean sitting down and negotiating with Israelis. He's never said that we need to sit down and negotiate with Israelis. He says by force. That's the only thing the Israelis understand. We want to give a man like that the Nobel Peace Prize? I don't know where more violence is being done, to the Nobel Peace Prize or to Archbishop Tutu or to public opinion. Before I leave the issue here of the way the media approach things, I want to give a couple more anecdotes that relate directly to things that happened to me and that I know about. The very first journalist who made contact with my family after Malki's murder was a program director from the BBC in London who was on the phone on the Sunday morning. Malki was buried on Friday afternoon. Sunday morning, I was sitting on the floor in my home as part of the Shiva. Somebody handed me the phone and said it's the BBC. And I listened to a woman who introduced herself as a program presenter. She has a daily program for the British market, not for BBC World. And she said, "I'm sorry for your loss. I'm wondering if you're willing to come on my program and speak about it." I hadn't actually contemplated that, but I intuitively felt yes. And I said, yes, I'd be willing to do that. She said, oh, good, because I've already arranged for the father of the young man who blew himself up to be on the program as well. And I'm quite sure, and I cut her off, and I said, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I won't be part of that. That's sickening to me. That's pornographic. She said, oh, I'm so surprised. Well, we'll give it some more thought. Thank you. And that was the end of that conversation. Some weeks later, I had a call from the Jerusalem representative of the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He's, in fact, the Middle East correspondent. He has, since what I'm about to tell you, gone on to become the key guy in the ABC, including being the ombudsman for several years, the man to whom public complaints are directed. His name is Tim Palmer. Tim Palmer sends me an email during the Shiva, and he says, "G'day, mate.
I'm not like the Americans. I'd like to talk to you when things get a bit quieter. Your daughter was an Australian, and the Aussie market is interested in hearing more. So let me know when you're okay to talk. Bye-bye. And I did give him a call right after the shiva, and we had one conversation. It's the only conversation we've ever had. That's significant, as you'll hear. And we spoke in Australian to Australian terms. He was very friendly. I was very friendly. And he said, now, what I'm really interested in is, can we do an interview with you? And I said, well, sure, mate. And he said, well, that's great, because I've just met the father of the bomber. And I said, well, what did you find out about him? He said, I sense that you're not happy. Let me tell you, mate, he's a friendly guy. He's in favor of peace. He's against what his son did. And I think this would be a really worthwhile thing. Now, as he's saying that, and I'm no genius, I was thinking in my mind, number one, Tim Bloody Palmer, do you speak Arabic? Of course you don't. So everything you know about this man, who you say is terribly cut up about what his son did, comes through a handler. I know how that works. I've met a lot of journalists. There's always a handler. The handler is an Arabic-speaking individual, very often an employee of the Palestinian Authority, sometimes affiliated with Hamas. And you're hearing exactly what they want you to hear. And you don't understand it, and you're being played for a fool. That's number one. Number two, what did this fellow actually say to you? Did he say, I would like to be paired up with the father of one of the victims of my son's lust for Jewish blood? Is that what this is about? Well, I didn't say these things to him. I just said, listen, mate, I think that the idea is appalling, and I'm not prepared to go ahead with it. He said, well, that's a shame, because most people would see this murder of your daughter as basically two sides of the same coin. And that's an expression that has rattled in my brain ever since. Tim Palmer framed it really well. He's an intelligent journalist, but on this subject, he's a total fool. And I have never said that to him, but I didn't need to, because what subsequently happened was I spoke very candidly to an Australian journalist about a year later who wrote an article in a major newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, about what Tim Palmer had done, how he had proposed to have me be in a double-headed interview with the father of my child's murderer. And astonishingly, that interview, written by an Australian journalist, Piers Ackerman, was the subject of a complaint made by Tim Palmer of the ABC, who said to the Australian Media Council, that he should have had the right of reply when Ackerman wrote the interview with me. Most people who know something about the media would say, what? But he succeeded. And in fact, Ackerman lost all appetite for fighting, and I was never allowed to even make a submission. So a very bad feeling that came out of that. That was the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. A journalist from Japan's most important newspaper came to see me at my place of work only a few weeks after Malki's death and was tremendously sympathetic and seemed to be writing everything down and seemed genuinely interested. He'd been hitchhiking through Israel for several weeks, and it was all going great until it was as if somebody threw a switch. And he said to me, I want to ask you about the way in which the kibbutz movement was created on the bones and the blood of the Palestinian Arabs. Can you tell me something about that? I said, what? And he pulled out a book from his pants, and it was a Japanese book, but I could see that there was an English title. The book was translated into Japanese from an English title. And indeed, it was a book that purported to tell the real story of the kibbutz movement as being essentially a genocidal operation intended to wipe out the connection between the Palestinian Arabs and their land. That was the end of that interview, and there was obviously no point in continuing. I don't think anybody really in this room knows what the Jordan Media Institute is, so I'm going to take a moment to just tell you. It's the most important training school in the entire Arab world for Arab journalists. It was started by a woman who used to be a journalist on CNN. She's the daughter of a former Algerian foreign minister. And she's today a princess in the Jordanian royal family. And being a princess with lots of clout and a woman who had a terrific career and a top-notch journalist, she set up about 5 years ago a school that would train Arab Arabic language journalists, a thing for which there is clearly a need, but which is highly problematic because in most of the Arab countries, you can't really do an honest job as a journalist. But I didn't need to get into that kind of analysis because of what I found a year ago. A year ago, because I scanned the Arabic newspapers all the time on the internet, I saw this page. Now, it's translated to English here, but in fact, it appears in Arabic. And what it is a page from the Jordan Media Institute's website in which it declares my daughter's murderer, Ahlam Tamimi, to be their role model. In other words, we are in journalism because this woman is our inspiration. I have to tell you that the woman who engineered the massacre, the one who decided that the young man with the guitar case on his back should blow himself up in the middle of the intersection of King George and Jaffa, that young woman, who was 21 years old at the time, was working as a journalist. And in fact, after she dropped him off in the center of Jerusalem, she rushed back before the explosion to Ramallah, to her place of work, which was a TV station, where she read the news that night. I've got photographs of her reading the news and announcing the liberation operation in the center of Jerusalem. She was subsequently caught, confessed openly, and has kept confessing all these years, and was sentenced to 15 terms of life imprisonment. At the Jordan Media Institute, they declared her to be their role model. I was enraged. I looked onto the website to see who provides the funding. I discovered that there are 7 foreign governments who provide funding. I wrote to all of them. I also wrote to some of the corporate sponsors. I can tell you that in the space of several weeks, I managed to get more than a third of the funding for the Jordan Media Institute cancelled from my own efforts. But I can also tell you that several governments completely ignored my request, including the government of Australia. And the Jordan Media Institute itself never responded to any of my letters and have simply buried the matter. I see this as something of real significance. It's bad enough that there are among the journalists who are the up-and-coming crop of really top-notch journalists in the Arab world, people who genuinely feel that Ahlam Tamimi, because of the 15 Jews she murdered, is somebody they want to emulate. That's bad enough. But when the institution itself deals with the revelation of this news by suppressing it and pretending that it never happened and persuading UNESCO, which was the main sponsor, to just stonewall, that's a serious problem for all of us. On the 7th of July 2005, the United Kingdom experienced Islamist terrorism on a grand scale. You may remember that a train was blown up in the underground and 2 buses were bombed. And there were many people killed. There were many arrests, there were trials, many people were sent to jail. And since then, there have been many more. This past week, it was revealed by the British police. For the note, that 2/3 of the people who were arrested at that within that period and afterwards have already been released, and according to the police, there's not a one of them who went through any regret or showed any inclination to not do the same thing again. At the same time, a news report which I saw just before I came to Portland said that the British police say that they have stopped 20 Islamist terror attacks in the United Kingdom in the last 2 years and have 550 suspected plots under investigation. Now, I'm not here making a political statement. I am here making a statement about how we're making big mistakes in relation to terrorism. If the people who perpetrated what in British terms, was a colossal outrage, are for the most part out of jail, and no one has observed the fact, no one has made anything of the fact, that when given the opportunity to be reprogrammed, to show repentance, they ostentatiously said, screw you, and were released. And now the British police have so much terrorism business on their hands that by their own account, they say they can't cope with it. We're hearing similar things in France and Belgium. These are very mild words, but if we can't respect the truth and confront it, we will never succeed. If we can't call terrorism violent extremism, excuse me, I mean the opposite. If we insist on calling terrorism violent extremism, and in so doing pretend that it's something very different from what it really is, we will never defeat it. If we allow these people out of prison when we know that they are ready to do the same thing again and to die for it, we are ensuring, we're guaranteeing that the problem will come back like an unwanted guest at the party. I don't speak as a politician. You've already picked up from me that politics is not something that I appreciate, and politicians I try to keep away from. But that doesn't mean that I can go to bed at night without being able to say to myself, I did something today. What can a person do? Well, first of all, my wife and I write a blog. This Ongoing War is a blog that we've been writing now for 10 years. We write it every day. It only talks about terrorism. It doesn't talk about Trump or Clinton or Netanyahu as a politician. It certainly talks about the decisions that these people take about terrorism. And when we want to criticize, we have our own channel. We have our own megaphone. We want people to hear it. We have a large following. We have a lot of people who read it every day. We have a Twitter account. We can be heard. We have an influence. And even if I can't get Murray Half, the deputy spokesperson of John Kerry, the State Department's head, to answer me, at least I have the satisfaction of knowing that thousands of people know that. That's something small. That's something that everybody could do. That's what the social media allows people to do. And I'm glad that I have the outlet, but I don't have any illusions about how much we're moving the needle. And here I come to something a little more philosophical. This is from the website of the charity that my wife and I started to preserve the name and the memory of our murdered daughter. And if you're looking for articles here about terrorism or criticism of the State Department, of course you won't find it. It's entirely devoted to what Malki stood for. And astonishingly, as a 15-year-old girl, she stood for something pretty significant. She stood for do everything you possibly can for children who need help. And that, as simple as that message is, so is what we do. Very simple, very straightforward. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. I'm not using this as an excuse to make a pitch to you, though I do plan to make a pitch tomorrow. But the significance of Israeli Jews like me, and there are thousands of us who have done the same thing, deciding that we want to do something that brings a little bit more light into the world in the name of our children or our partners or our parents or our friends who were murdered by these savages in the name of a savage ideology. That says something very positive. If you'll ask me why for 15 years have I been pumping this organization to the point where it's really effective, I've never worked in the organization. I'm the honorary chairman. My wife is an honorary advisor. We have a professional staff, a small professional staff. We've never taken a penny. We never will take a penny. We put money in. We don't take it out. Why do we do this? For two reasons. The first, hear me carefully, so that I can stand in front of groups and I can say, this was my daughter, Malki. I want you to know about her life. And it lets me do that. I've spoken to thousands of people, to hundreds of journalists, and I always say that. That's the first thing. The second thing is to make it possible for me to look myself in the mirror and say every night, there's simply no doubt. They, the murderers, the Islamists, Ahlam Tamimi, and the thousands of people who adore her, they're over there and we're over here. We're not two sides of the same coin. We're being driven by entirely different needs, entirely different impulses. That's more important than you might think, because at the end, when you've lost a child to an act of hatred, it is different from a car accident or, heaven forbid, a life-ending illness. I can give you a few answers, but I'll only give you one answer. The most striking way in which it's different is that in the case of terrorism, they want to do it to my other children. And they want to do it to my wife and me, and they want to do it to everybody who lives on my street. They want to do it to you, and they want to do it to anybody else that they can. If we don't stop them, they will. You think I'm being pompous and exaggerating and over-dramatizing it, but I'm actually not. The capacity of people in the name of an insane perversion of an ideological thrust that is based on a religion to create enormous mayhem is practically unlimited. And we're not beating them. We're not even fighting back. We're not fighting back the right way. We're not understanding our own losses. We're not understanding our own victims. And most of all, we're not understanding how the narrative, which means the media, is spinning reality in ways that will make it eventually impossible for people to even understand that we have a problem before it'll be too late. We're heading to the point where it'll be too late. I jumped past the last slide. I want to thank you for the opportunity to get up here and say these things. It's not a small privilege. I hope I have impressed on you that the problem is a real one, and that even if I'm wrong in all of my descriptions and prescriptions, I'm at least unsettling you about the possibility that things aren't being done the best way. Not in your country, not in my country. I don't want to sound like I'm being dismissive of Europe, but certainly not in Europe. Europe is going down the toilet in front of our eyes in ways that time just doesn't allow me to say. I've spent a lot of time in Europe talking to prime ministers and foreign ministers, and the incomprehension is going to be the worst thing that they've ever done. It's not too late. The answer here is not to change the politics of the United States. It's to focus on the victims. Once people walk around with the faces of the victims in their minds and understand the hugeness of the price that we're paying by not addressing the ugly forces that took this young man's life and my daughter's life, we're never going to succeed. I hope you've got energy enough to express some viewpoints to each other now and certainly some questions. And again, I want to thank you for the opportunity. I want to again thank Rabbi Kozak and the authorities here at the shul and, of course, the Shure family who've made it all possible. And I want to thank you for coming out here tonight. Thank you.
I think it's very important to talk about the opportunity to have allies in the Islam world, in all over the world, on the war on terror. But in order to do that, it's hard to say that nowadays my country, Israel, is an obstacle on the war on terror. We are one of the obstacles on the way for an all-world cooperation for the war on terror. Because in order to do that, said our friend, General Sisi of Egypt, he said, if you don't go forward on negotiating with the Palestinians and willing to evacuate the settlements from the West Bank, there will not be a cooperation on the war on terror. My nephew was killed by ISIS, and they are very dangerous for the world peace. It's hurt me to know that my country has become an obstacle for the war on terror. Thank you.
Okay, any comments, questions?
Well, I've got one. I took particular notice that you made a point of bringing up the terrorist releases, which were a substitute for the first demand made in the lead up to those negotiations, which was a settlement freeze. And that was highly controversial in Israeli politics, I know. And then I also took note in your presentation of looking at Marwan Barghouti, who is a very important figure in Palestinian politics today. So I have a first question, and if you have satisfy that in your mind, then I have a second question. I'll be very brief. What I want to hear from you is, have you personally really taken some time and looked at what happened in South Africa with the truth and reconciliation process? And I'm not layering this with any opinion from my point. I'm just saying, have you spent time looking at that and reflecting on it? If that is yes, then I would really like to know how you view that society's process of reconciliation of people who were terrorists in that process of trying to come to rebuilding that society.
Yes. I've also had the experience of speaking with journalists who have interviewed Tutu and have shared my sense that his viewpoint on larger issues outside of South Africa, his viewpoint is not a respectable one. In the case of South Africa, there was a desire to find a way to live together. And both sides, then and now, worked hard in different ways to ensure that there was a shared future. If you believe that the conflict in our part of the world involves the same kind of dynamic, two sides opposed to each other but essentially ready to live in peace with one another, then you'll not agree with me. But it's very clear to me that so long as Arab children, and particularly Palestinian Arab children, are educated to the idea that Jews are infected with an original sin and cannot be lived with and have no rights, then we're not heading towards anything that will be capable of being addressed by a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That, frankly, is as much as I want to say about the political dimension of all of this, because as important as the issue is, it isn't the issue that I came here to talk about. I have said to you that my feelings about Tutu in particular are strong and filled with negativism. I think what he's doing now is shameful and bring no great credit on him at all. And I was relieved to see that many people share my view in other countries, particularly in South America. Maybe we'll continue this offline, because I have more that I would say that I don't really want to share with an audience.
Anyone?
Just over here.
I, not too long ago, saw about a group of Israelis and Palestinians who both suffered losses. Are you aware? I'm sure you are aware. And is it helpful?
You're referring to the Parents Circle Families Forum. It's a discussion topic which I think will be polarizing here. I've been watching them for 15 years. I have quite strong views about them. Unlike most other people, I have strong views which are actually based on real information and real knowledge. And I don't find that their role is helpful for anybody except for the people who are involved in the organization itself. The organization claims to do things which certainly they do not do, and has made a contribution which, in my opinion, is entirely negative.
That Arafat started suicide bombing originally, that the Nobel Prize was given to Arafat. I think it would be effective if the Nobel Committee abrogated that prize. And I think it would make a statement, but I don't think it's very realistic.
Right. I'm not sure that anything good would come out of rescinding an award that was made in 1994, but I take your point. If anyone here is in the room is expecting me to come to the defence of Yasser Arafat, I won't. I think that his contribution was entirely negative and destructive, but he's dead, and there's not much that his role today... Well, we have to pray harder to make sure that the resurrection fails.
Are you aware of a series of schools, and I don't remember how many, Hands Across, whatever, is organized by a young man from Portland, and their purpose is to educate Arab and Israeli children side by side. They don't have too many of them, and probably only a few thousand are affected, but they seem to have some kind of positive effect on those who are participating.
I think you're talking about Yad B'Yad, but if somebody knows better than me, okay. I'll answer you by saying that in the work of the Malki Foundation, more than a third of the families we help are Palestinian Arabs. From a philosophical point of view, I'm entirely of the view that we should be helping and doing whatever we can, and they should be helping us, and we should be helping each other. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that way. It first of all has to be said that nothing of that kind is happening on the other side of the fence, nothing. There are no steps towards cooperation, even though there are articles, and I see them at least as much as you see them here in Portland. I'm quite obsessive on the subject, claiming that there are all sorts of undertakings, maybe below the radar, to get Palestinian Arabs to understand the Israeli position better. I'm in a position to say that I don't believe any of that, but I believe that the need for this is huge, and if we could find a way to do it more effectively, great. At the human level, that's the easiest part. At the human level, we should be helping each other. I have a clean conscience on this subject. We have, at this point, probably about 1,000 Palestinian Arab families who have benefited directly through the work of the Malki Foundation, and I think that's as it should be. But it would be a big mistake to think that somehow the two parties are coming closer and closer, and it's only those idiotic politicians who are getting in the way. It isn't working that way. You can see this from the large number of Palestinian Arab children who have either been killed trying to kill Israelis in the last year or have been in support of those efforts. We have a terrible situation on the other side. The other side legitimately, sincerely, believes that their children are expendable for the cause, and I don't think there are any Jews who think like that. Anybody want to say anything about their own viewpoints to each other? Here you go.
Maybe I need a clarification for you. You talked in terms of confronting terrorism, and you alluded to the media. You alluded to keeping the terrorists in prison. At least that's what I understood.
Right, and sharpening the terminology when government talks about the terrorists.
Okay. Am I missing something? Is there something beyond that that you share with us or that I just missed?
At the very beginning of my speech, I said, I have nothing here to say about law enforcement or military strategies or what societies and governments should do. So far be it for me to try to offer a solution. I can only do everything that an enthusiastic canary in the coal mine can do about waving a flag and saying, it's all wrong. You're going about this all wrong. What should you do? I mean, it's a serious answer. I'm not trying to be flippant about this. I don't really have any prescriptions.
Pass it back. I mean, we're experiencing things in this town right now that are the beginning or elements, for reasons that probably most people in this room may agree with initially, but are starting to get out of hand, you know, are part of what you're talking about.
But you're still not talking about terrorism, thank God, in Portland or anywhere else in the circles that you're describing. It really is a different phenomenon. Political protest is a serious issue. I'm not making light of it, but it's not the same thing. Terrorism is driven by an ideology that seeks domination. And that's a whole different world. The guys who are protesting outside the synagogue where I was davening this afternoon, there's a group of Portland protesters making their way down Vermont Avenue, they're not about to blow you up. They're not about to blow anybody up. They don't want to kill people. They're angry. There's a big difference, in my view. I don't think I can say anything that you don't already know, to be frank. What you see in Europe is a dangerous combination which, in their own terms, they're regretting. I'm fighting every urge to be prescriptive, so I'll be descriptive in a very limited sense. And it's a personal experience, and it didn't happen yesterday, it happened in 2004. In another one of the delegations that I was part of, I met with the Speaker of the Belgian Senate. His name was Armand de Decker, and he was a pompous jackass. I mean, he was a politician. I've just repeated myself, I'm sorry. This was at the time when efforts were being made in Belgium to drag Sharon in front of a Belgian court to answer for war crimes. And there's Belgium is not the only country in the world that has this universal jurisdiction claim that allows them to pretend to be interested in bringing some politician from some other country. So the question that came from one of the members of the group that I was part of was, why are you Belgians so anti-Semitic? It wasn't a well-formulated question. It was actually quite stupid. De Decker is a smart fellow. And here's what he said. I've said it so many times that I can really commit it to memory, speaking from memory. He said, "You're making a big mistake. There's no passion in any of this. This isn't a reflection on Belgian society." Oh, and I should say one other thing before I continue. He is from one of the right-wing parties. I think he's a Flemish, I've forgotten the name. There's a right-wing Flemish party. And he's still in politics. He said, "What happened here 20 years ago is we decided to bring in a large number of Moroccans. We needed the workers. And here we are 20 years later, and the most common name for newborn babies in Belgium today is Mohammed. It isn't going to change. It's only going to continue. The horse has escaped the stable, and we can't close the gate anymore. And these changes are not going to disappear. They're going to get stronger and stronger, so people will be doing things that you don't like, and there's nothing we can do about it." Now, that's not a satisfying answer, but I think it's an accurate answer. I think that what he was saying was, the Europe that you're thinking about doesn't exist anymore, and if it does, it won't be here for much longer. And the change is a change that is entirely demographic. There will be more Arabs. By more Arabs, that means more Muslims. By more Muslims, that means the creeping process of conformity with messages that emanate from mosques. And before you know it, you've got a situation where Jews are in a very uncomfortable position. One of these days, there's going to be terrorism directed at Jews in Europe. Of course, I'm joking when I say this, because Jews are already under the hammer big time in Europe, in practically every country in Europe. The country that I have the greatest visibility into is Sweden, where I have a Gentile friend who is the sweetest, dearest person and has a real aching heart for what's happening to the Jews. And we speak once a week, and he says, "I don't recognize this country anymore. The country has turned on its head." Now, he doesn't mean the people have changed. He means the demographics have changed. They have a phenomenal number of people who have arrived in the last 2 years who are Arabs and most who are Muslims, and many of them are Arabs. And the political atmosphere has become very, very difficult. And I think my friend would agree that it isn't going to get any easier. It's just going to continue in that direction. Okay, we're heading off into an area that I really did not want to address. You can say whatever you want to say, of course, but if it's like in this area of political issues, I'm very keen to try to avoid them. Now.
Well, it is, actually, I wanted to have your thoughts about what Daniel said about Israel being an obstacle for
the fight against terror. And Can you elaborate or give your thoughts about that?
I'll repeat the question. Can I elaborate on the statement that Galia made, that Israel is an obstacle or the obstacle to getting to peace with the Arabs?
No, that's not what I said.
No. So, I choose not to engage in that subject.
I was just wondering, the treatment that you got, that you were telling us about after your daughter was killed, in the ultra-Orthodox community there in Israel, are they treated the same when they lose one of their family members? Do people choose to not, you know, greet them or walk away from them?
Oh, at the social level? I don't know. What's your theory?
What's my theory? I guess when, I mean, they seem to be such a close community, and that when one of them is killed, that they all gather together.
I'll stick my neck out a little bit here. I mean, I have... Almost all my relatives in Israel belong to the Haredi end of the spectrum, so I see some things, but I'm no authority. This is personal and it's anecdotal, and I'm not talking about terror victims now. I'm going to talk about disabled children, because there are one heck of a lot more disabled children in the Haredi world than there are terror victims, and in fact there are one heck of a lot more disabled children among the Haredim than there are in any other segment of Israeli society except for the Arabs. The reason for the Haredim having so many disabled children is they have large families. The reason for the Arabs having so many is that they have so many cousins who marry each other, which leads to a phenomenal degree of neurological damage. So I know from personal experience that in the Haredi world, if you have a disabled child, there is a strong compulsion to hide that child from public view and not to deal with the issue. Now, I'm not going to expand on this because I think this audience isn't ready for this, frankly. I think you need to know something more about the way the Haredi world works in order to put this into a context. Haredim are not bad people. They're not more bad than any other group of people that I can think of. But there is something about the need to marry off your children and to do it without the fear that somebody will see that there's a disabled child in the back room, lest the shidduch will be affected. So it sounds like I'm being flippant. Well, I don't know if it sounds that way, but I'm not being flippant at all. It's a real issue. People often don't give their disabled children the attention that they need because of a fear that this would involve public exposure. Now, I can tell you that being the chairman of the Malki Foundation gives me a unique perspective into both the Arab disabled children world and the Haredi disabled children world. And sometimes we find ourselves pushing the families to take advantage of things that we're offering them, which are basically therapies and equipment, non-medical therapies, physical occupation, speech, horse and water. Physical occupation, speech, horse and water. That's where we spend all our money, on providing those therapies for disabled children. We often find ourselves having to push the family to take advantage of what we're prepared to give them, because there's a reluctance to have their child exposed even to people who live on the same street, let alone to society at large. Now, it's not what you asked, and I don't really know how it works with terror victims, but the truth is that in the Haredi world, there have been terror victims, but it's not a major component of their lives. And I'm sorry if I'm not giving you a better answer than that. Okay, I think we're probably done, and I want to thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you. Can I just also mention to you that tomorrow at 3 o'clock here, I'm going to be speaking about the work of the Malki Foundation, which in my opinion is in some ways exemplary in the way in which it deals with the challenges right across the spectrum, Palestinian Arab children, Israeli Arab children, regular Israelis who are among the mainstream parts of the society. It has, of course, no political dimension whatsoever, but the need for it is a story in itself, and that's what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. So again, thank you very much for your kind attention.